Feeling overwhelmed by today's headlines? Imagine being Lark Chadwick, a journalist, pregnant, and suddenly living in a country where abortion is a crime and a dictator has taken power. I've got an author I want you to meet whose gripping political thriller provides a chillingly relevant story of courage, control, and the cost of freedom. Stick around because you'll not only learn more about the book, you'll learn about the writing journey this author took to create it.
Welcome to a Book Finds You podcast. This week's guest is John Dedekis. Join us as he shares the inspiration behind his book, along with his writing process, routines, and challenges. And now here's your host, best-selling author, Rob Jollis.
Today's guest, John Dedekis, is a former White House correspondent and former senior copy editor on CNN's The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer. John's book, Enemies Domestic, is already piling up a bunch of awards, and you're going to want to hear why. Happy to have you with us, and welcome to the show, John.
Thank you, Rob. It's good to be here.
Excellent. Well, we'll start with how the book found you, and then maybe we'll climb into this one a little bit. But, you know, we always say the book doesn't find us, we find it. So how did this book find you?
This came about when the abortion decision, when Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022. Mm-hmm. My wife and I have coffee every morning at 8. And as soon as that happened, my wife said to me, "You need to write about this," because my fifth novel, Fake, ended with my protagonist, Lark Chadwick, pregnant. We had she didn't know how it was going to go. And so I had the perfect opportunity to put Lark in a post-Roe era and sort of work that through.
And are we calling this a fictional book?
It's fiction, but it's ripped from reality. I mean, I quote, you know, some of the candidates at the time. You know, Trump, when he declared his candidacy, he said, "I am your warrior. I am your retribution." And I've got a character saying that as well. So there's a definite echo of what's going on right now.
Yeah, "I'm your retribution." I think that we were his retribution, but I'm not so sure about that. I remember when I'm a D.C. Resident, and I think you're around D.C. area. I remember when Marion Barry was mayor, then, of course, got caught up in a little crack issue. But then when he came out, he ran on basically, "I'm running for you all and the challenges and struggles that you've had," and was reelected with it.
Oh, I mean, you know, this country is amazing in terms of the way it goes about making political decisions. The joke at the time, when the reason that the Democrats didn't have their convention in D.C. is that Marion Barry couldn't promise that he'd have the streets shoveled by August.
Never heard that before. I thought maybe the potholes fixed by August, but
oh, that'll never happen.
Yeah, shoveling, huh? That's very well. He was, as he said, a night owl, and that was our main man, Marion. Anyway, okay. So this book, first of all, I think I read somewhere it's won a few of awards. How's it doing?
It's doing very well. The most recent award it got was the grand prize for the Chanticleer Clue Award for Best Suspense Thriller for 2024. That was the top of the heap of a lot of people who submitted. So that's very encouraging. It's gotten the Pen Craft and Feathered Quill and a few others. Didn't get the Pulitzer, though.
Not this time.
Not this time.
Well, yeah, it's you've got a sort of a divided audience there. Are you getting any pushback from one side or the other?
Not really. And that is a relief. I mean, yeah. You know, you can't please everybody. And so right. I know that, There are probably some people who aren't happy. But on the other hand, I wrote it so that no matter where you come down on the abortion issue, you're going to feel as if your opinion is fairly represented because it's a very complex issue. It's very personal. I've been on all sides of it myself. And my wife and I have had some spirited conversations about it. So I feel that I've tried to present it fairly, and apparently, at least so far, people seem to think I have.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, if we have a certain part of the society right now that just isn't listening, and that's on both sides, blue and red, and that's fine. But it really is kind of refreshing to me when we just get to a place where we can listen. And one of the things that I wrote an article a while back about changing somebody's political mind, and the only rule that that I went into was, if you think you're going to do that, and I'm a man of hope, by the way. Just go into the conversation willing to have your mind changed.
True.
And a lot of time, unfortunately, I think that's where we run into trouble. I want to change your mind, but I have no interest in hearing your part of the story.
Oh man, and when Trump was president the first time, I that was when I lost hope, at least short term, that we're going to be able to find common political ground. And what I discovered is that, it's just wishful thinking to believe that if you lob a rhetorical artillery shell into the enemy camp and it goes off, it's going to change everything. No, it's just going to provoke more pushback.
Right.
And so I'm at the point now where I think that whatever common ground we can find is going to be on the human level. How are you doing? How's the family doing? How's the health? How's the job? That kind of stuff. And if we can meet there, I think there's hope.
Yeah. Times like these, I miss a particular journalist. I miss Tim Russert. I
Yeah.
miss Tim Russert because I remember, when we had elections and Tim Russert would go over a certain point that disagreed with mine, I immediately thought, I have to re-look at my point of view because I know that Tim Russert has no stake in the game here. He's just presenting information. He's not red, he's not blue. He's just presenting information, factual information. And going way back in the days of Walter Cronkite, and just we never really questioned our journalists, did we?
No, that's actually not true, because
No.
when Cronkite was the anchor, Uncle Walter,
Yeah.
remember Nixon was president, and he sent Spiro Agnew around the country talking about, nattering nabobs of negativism and calling journalists an effete corps of impudent snobs. It was
Wow.
just a more elegant way of saying fake news,
Yeah.
because reporters were digging up evidence of obstruction of justice in Nixon's presidency during Watergate. They called, when LBJ was president, the briefings in Saigon were considered the 5 o'clock follies, because reporters would go in the field with units, and whatever was being spewed out of the briefing sessions in Saigon bore no resemblance to what they were seeing in the field. And so when the war effort was questioned, reporters were excoriated for, being on the opposite side of the country. So no, this is it has been a we have a long history of the press and the president being in an adversarial relationship.
I'm glad you taught me that today because Nixon, I was still kind of junior high-ish, and I was following things, but from pretty far back, and so I this felt new to me, but I'm glad you shared that with me. That's interesting.
Thank you.
It's one of the things, and self-disclosure, John and I had a conversation before we went on the air, and John has a podcast. And so from one podcaster to the other, the thing I love about podcasting the most is sitting in the host seat is how much I learn from my guests. I
Yeah.
don't learn it when I'm writing a blog. I learn it when I'm conducting a podcast.
Yeah, podcasts are really dynamic, and I came across it at the beginning of COVID. We had Zoom. It was like, that was your window to the outside world. And good God, I've been a journalist for 45 years. Interviewing is my strong suit. Curiosity is a strong motivator. And so I just found people to ask questions of. And when you ask, when you're listening, you're learning.
Right.
And so just following your curiosity is fabulous.
Yeah. Well, this must be fun for you when you get to sit in the other chair occasionally, right? Rob, you do the heavy lifting today.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. You know, where do you want to go next? Next question.
There you go. Well, here's my next question for you. Let's go back. You're sitting there with your wife and she says, you got to write a book about this. But there are a lot of people listening that have dreamt of writing a book, but don't know whether an idea is worth pursuing. And author to author now, we run into that too. So that's an interesting conversation. Then what happened? Because we still have to struggle with, is this going to be worth pursuing?
Oh, that's, yeah, I'm really glad you asked that follow-up, because I usually plan my books. I have an idea of where I'm going. I'm not a meticulous planner, but I at least like to know where I'm going. But I find that I don't plan things nearly as well as I thought I did. And so I'm also doing a lot of seat of the pants writing as well. Mm-hmm. But in Enemies Domestic, the most recent book that we're talking about, this one was pretty much seat of the pants. The process was, Cindy and I would talk, I'd have some ideas, I'd come down here really excited about the possibilities, but then you look at the blank screen and there's despair.
Right.
But if I can get my characters talking to each other, then there's hope. And it's like having little flashlights on your knuckles. You know, they throw just enough light down the path so that you can write a little bit more. So I'd write maybe 2,000 words, take it upstairs, Cindy would read it, and then we're back in despair again.
Back to despair. How many books do you have?
Enemies Domestic is the sixth. They're all mystery suspense thriller. My protagonist, Lark Chadwick, is a young woman in her 20s. And I've just started book seven. The working title is Cradle in the Crosshairs.
Ooh, I like that. Now, do you have control over your titles?
I've never had a problem with any of the publishers wanting me to change the titles. And frankly, I'm very flexible on that. This is a working title. It's probably going to go through a lot of changes before it's done.
Well, I just want to put a pin there, and I want people to just take a breath and hear what you just heard, because most authors, that's very refreshing, by the way, most authors, they really get, they hear that title, they live with it, they sleep with it, they breathe it. And if you self-publish a book, you can call it whatever you want. But when you conventionally publish, the publishers are usually pretty free with the inside of the book, other than grammar and syntax, and there's an editor for that. They're not going to fight you on that, but they're going to fight you on a title, because they know what catches the eye and what sells. And we need to convince authors, it's like a house. Like the house, but don't fall in love with the house yet. It's not your house yet.
That's excellent advice. You really have to be flexible, because you're writing for an audience of one, and that one can make the difference on whether somebody sees your book or not.
Right. And if we say it enough, it just gets so embedded. So I'm always encouraging people, fall in love with that title of yours, and then keep a document open and just keep throwing titles in there. Don't shut the spigot off. It's not time to contract yet. You're still expanding.
Exactly. And I just finished writing a memoir. The seventh draft is probably the best that it can be for now. And I've started pitching it, and it's probably gone through about 24 titles.
Mm. Yeah. And that's fine. And I don't mention titles in my books, and I won't right now, but I'll tell you, the best-selling book I ever wrote had the worst title I thought they could possibly come up with. And so that's when I went, okay, this is one of those things that, Rob, you don't know. That's why you're working with them. I'm good on the inside. All right, let's talk about, you've got a bunch of books now. Let's talk about your writing routine. And so what does that look like? You know, and I'll just leave it there. What does the writing look like in a typical week? Not a day, because we have things come up day to day.
Well, I mean, I've got procrastination nailed, so I'm really good at that. I do have a writing routine. I worked overnights at CNN for like 17 years. So my body has been bludgeoned into submission. And I've discovered that I can really only sleep about 5 hours before my body just says, okay, dude, time to get going. And lately, probably within the last month or two, I've been getting up without an alarm anywhere between 2 in the morning and 6 in the morning. The sweet spot is around 4, and it's the pre-dawn hour. I see that scowl, like, how can a human being do that? But it works for me because it's the pre-dawn hours. You're fresh, there are no interruptions, and that's my sweet spot, and I've just discovered that.
Oh. All right. Yes, that's the beauty of a podcast. Only John could see my eyebrow like pretty much raise up out of my head just a moment ago. I don't mind 6 o'clock. I'm a little annoyed at 2 o'clock, and I just want to make sure you might want to be sleep tested. We'll get back to the show now, but because that it could be a sleep issue.
It isn't really. I've got a neurologist friend who deals in sleep deprivation issues. And I remember when I was working at CNN and I discovered that I'm only getting 5 hours of sleep, I went to him and I said, dude, don't you need like 8 hours? And he said, it depends. He said, what it really you need is REM sleep, dream sleep. And I said, well, I get that. And he said, well, you should be okay. And I said, well, I wasn't sure yet. And I said, well, what does it mean if I can sleep for like 20 minutes and wake up refreshed? And he said, it means you're a good napper. And so after that, I never worried about sleep again.
Okay. Well, as your doctor, I'd still like you sleep tested and not verbally tested on your sleep, but okay, we'll move on. I'll tell you what I got out of what you just said, though, in a very positive way, which is I'm sure as an author, you've got a lot of people that come up to you and say, I've always dreamt of writing a book, always wanted to write a book. And part of the problem that people have is time. I do love the idea of getting up earlier. I mean, when people tell me I don't have another minute in the day, what time do you get up? 7. Well, now you're getting up at 6. Now you
There you
have an
go.
hour every day. So I like the fact that you figured out the early hours. I'm just not a fan of 2, but that's, I'm just your friend. I'm not your doctor. So
It's a it's
I'm stubborn, as you could tell, but we'll push on from there.
okay.
But I do. I like the fact that you're getting up early. I'm the same as you. I'm much sharper in the morning if you want to, if I'm writing. Any place in particular you prefer to write?
Down here at my desk in the basement, I've got a nice view out the window. Of course, at 2 in the morning, I don't.
This dark view, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, and to a certain extent, you don't want to have those distractions either. But but look, I can write anywhere. I mean, as a journalist, you can't wait for the muse to show up. You just got to write. And so I can pretty much write anywhere, but this is my best
Okay.
place.
And how about from what are some of the more challenging parts of writing for you? What's the toughest part of writing for you?
I think the toughest part is just getting that idea and letting it play out. It's that blank screen that's the hardest part. The most fun is the rewrite, the buffing and the polishing. The hardest part is making it coherent, making it as if you're proud of it and that you feel someone else will enjoy it.
Well, and particularly because you're not an outlining kind of guy, it sounds like. I write business books that, I'm in awe of the fiction authors because when you write a business book, you're really kind of just regurgitating information. It's not that hard to complete an outline. So, I don't sit there and go, what's today? What's on today's menu? Whereas a fictional writer, it doesn't, we can't necessarily outline the entire fictional book. It depends on style.
It depends. Well, you can. I mean, there are some writers like Hank Phillippe Ryan. She just wings it,
Right.
and her first draft is like 125,000 words, and then she and her editor make it coherent. There's Jeffrey Deaver, who and I think James Patterson. They are meticulous outliners. I mean, their outlines are like 50 pages, and Deaver has told me that that's sometimes where he decides whether or not he's going to do the book. If he can't make the outline make sense, he just moves on to the next thing. And it just depends.
Have you ever abandoned a project?
I think I have only because, they just kind of atrophy and, you move on to something else. It's not like you say, oh, this sucks and I'm never going to look at it again. It's just that, you move on. So lately, the projects that I have, I pretty much stick with. But I think if I were to go back into my files, I'd go, oh, yeah, I forgot about that one.
Well, and I always like to flush that out a little bit because, again, when we have people that are thinking of writing books, and I don't know about you, but one of the greatest joys for me is if I can lend a hand or at least an idea is seeing somebody come out with their first book. It's just joyous because you know what it felt like when your first book came out, and when you know what somebody else is about to experience. But I'm always concerned about the abandoning of projects. And it's a tough line because sometimes that's what we need to do. And other times, that's exactly what we don't need to do. And so we have to listen to that voice in our head, and it's tough.
It is, and there's nothing more that I like to do than to inspire people to write their first book. I mean, I do a lot of teaching and one-on-one coaching, and many of my clients and students are just starting out. They've had this idea for a long time, but they don't have a clue how to do it. And so it really is fun to show them, teach them the lessons I learned through making all the mistakes I made.
And I'll ask you at the end, but seeing as we're nibbling it right now, how would people get a hold of you if they wanted to maybe use your services to help flush out a book?
Sure. The best way to do that is through my website, which is myname.com. It's a tricky Greek one. I'll spell it. It's Johnd as in dog E, D as in dog A, KIS as in Sam.com, johndedakis.com.
Yeah, and I just call him John. And would you do me a favor in those classes? Wait, right? The last module that you teach somebody to write a book, would you remind them that they've got to market that book too?
Oh,
I think,
that's one of the
yeah,
sessions. Yeah.
good. Because I think that I'm always surprised that authors almost run out of gas. And it's no, you just gave birth to a child. Now, if any parents are listening, we do the best we can at raising our children. Then they go out in the world and we hope they live a good life. And it's really out of our hands at that point, but we want to make sure we give them the best opportunity for a good life. I wish people would approach their books that way.
I mean, they really, I think a lot of people just assume that if you get a book contract, the publisher takes it from there. Even if you're getting it with Random House or one of the bigs, the pressure is on you to make that connection with the reader. And it need not be as daunting as it sounds, because it's not selling, it's telling. You're just looking for new ways to let people know you've written a book.
That's it. That's it. But just save some energy in the tank for that part of it. And I will tell you, one of my books is with Simon and Schuster as an example. Nothing. I mean, 3 days of a 22-year-old, first job in as a publicist, sending out a few hundred copies here or there, getting the 3% return, and then taking care of the wall of books that are now approaching his or her desk. But no, it really doesn't matter. Small publisher, big publisher, indie, it falls on the author. And so I'm just reminding authors, all the passion you put in the book, put it into the marketing too. And if you do, and you can convince, you have that conversation going in, you're going to attract a lot more publishers.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true.
So let's talk about your publishing part of this. We're coming down the home stretch. What was your path to getting published for you?
Well, it I was juggling a day job and overnights at CNN and raising three kids and a wife and all that kind of stuff. So, I had to squeeze it in when I could. So it took a while, but I think that the key for me was going to writers' conferences. And there was one at the University of Georgia near Atlanta, and I went there every year. And they had agents there, authors. I mean, I learned a lot about the business and the process, but I'm such a slow learner that I finally realized I can pitch the agent before I get there. And so that's how I got my agent. I pitched her ahead of time, said, I'm going to be at the conference, looking forward to meeting you. And I met her and a couple of others who were also interested. And it's like dating. You got it, you date and pretty soon you fall in love, and there it is. And so that was the process. I think writers' conferences are critical to getting you out of your shell, because a lot of writers are shy and or introverts.
Yes.
And you can still be you at a writers' conference, just by sopping up all of that wisdom that's there, and in the process, making friends.
Right. Well, let's put a plug in for the Maryland Writers Association, because they have their conference every year in Baltimore, I believe it is. And I was at the la at last year's, and there was a whole bunch of agents there
Yes.
that you could make appointments with and talk to your work about. So there's one in our own backyard.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's called Brain to Bookshelf, and I attended your class on podcasting,
Oh.
and you're right. In fact, there was one agent panel that was a great takeaway for me, because the agents were instructed to raise their hand when they were listening to the first page of an anonymously submitted manuscript, and they listened to several of them, and they raised their hands at the point where they said they would be sending a rejection letter. And this, we're talking the first page. And more often than not, they were raising their hand because the writer got off to a great start, great open, and then they started to do backstory. It's like, get the story going. And I
Right.
mean, when agents tell you that they will reject you that fast, it's time to listen and make adjustments, and don't do 100 pages of setup
Right.
and atmospherics.
Yeah. I mean, a case study would be the show that you're on right now. I continue to work with authors on how to create a hook. And authors confuse that with a synopsis of their story. And so I don't want to hit the agent with necessarily a long synopsis of the story. I wasn't there, but I'm pretty sure that's what was going on. And as fascinating as it is to you, we have to create more of a hook to get that individual or audience. It's a great skill to learn.
And I think what's a hook? A hook is making the person want to turn the page,
Right.
to answer. You're raising questions that you'll pay off with answers as they keep going. So you need to intrigue. I think that's the essence of a hook.
You got it. Well, my day job is, and I write sales books, and I do a lot of workshops, seminars, keynotes on sales. And in the sales industry, we have something we refer to as a WIFM. It's an acronym, WIFM, and it stands for What's in It for Me. And I that's a version of that is what we're looking for. I think we're looking for it early in our preface anyway, when we write a book. Of trying to attract that reader, maybe that whiff them on the back cover of that book. If we are lucky enough for somebody to actually have that physically in their hands or on their screen at Amazon, let's make sure that there's a hook there and not necessarily a long synopsis of the story.
Exactly. I just wrote down WIFM, what's in it for me?
There you
Thank you,
go.
sir.
All right. See, we're exchanging today. I owed you one, at least. Okay. A couple more questions. We'll begin to bring it in for a landing. How about this one? What do you think is one of your best ideas, tips, techniques for you when you're marketing your book? Because as we said, doesn't matter how big or small your publisher is, it's going to fall on us, a lot of it. So what would be a good idea if you were just going to grab one, cherry pick one? What idea would you provide?
The idea for me is, I think it's a mindset. The mindset is, it's relational. It's about building relationships. And you do that one by one by one, as opposed to some sort of, mass blast email. And if you think in terms of, just trying to complete the circuit between what you've written and having someone read it, then, I think that's going to go a long way. So, being able to collect emails from, people who buy your book or people you meet at a writer's conference, and just keeping track, keep those in your Rolodex and have it expand, because there'll come a time when an agent is going to say, well, tell me more about your social media platform. How many people are on your mailing list? And because that's where the book sales will eventually happen. But it's relations. And of course, and social media is great at being able to do that. My wife kids me about my 5,000 closest friends on Facebook. But you know what? I know a lot of them. And so that's really, I think, one of the hidden payoffs. What's in it for me? Sure, you're trying to sell books, you're trying to get people interested in your story, but you make friends. And that's wonderful.
Yeah, that's a great idea. You jog something in my memory. I always like swapping, trying to come up with an idea when I've got somebody on. So I'm going to give you one that I've never really mentioned before, but it's going to dovetail what you just said. I had you remember the great Zig Ziglar? Did you ever hear
Yeah.
of Zig?
Oh, sure.
I near the end of his time, I got to know him a bit, and I got to know his son Tom, and I interviewed Tom once, and I said, what's one lesson that you would like to share? And he said, I sat at the table with my father with presidents, CEOs, very impressive people. And I just assumed that those contacts would be there forever. And he said, and if I could go back, I would take those relationships more seriously and maintain them. I'm going to add my own word, almost like a garden, continuing to
Ooh, good.
feed and
Yep.
water the garden, because one leaves but brings another in, and we need to get introduced. And
Yeah.
that's how we maintain that access to those great network connections. But too
Right.
often people get blindsided and say, well, 10 years ago, I knew. You got to stay on top of these things.
Yeah, it really is true. Yeah. I
And
like
thanks.
that. I like the garden analogy. That's
Yeah.
great.
Thanks to Tom Ziegler for that one. All right.
Yeah.
Last question for you.
All right.
Again, we've got aspiring writers listening, and maybe somebody's at the 1 yard line right now and they're thinking, I'd love to write a book like that, a fictional book. What's one more thing you might tell somebody who's just sitting on the sidelines and thinking about it?
Well, don't give up. If you've got an idea that's been nagging at you for years, that tells you something. And writers, at the root of writer's block is fear. Fear of being rejected, fear of not being perfect, fear of, whatever. And it can happen when you sit down and you're ready to write, and it's like, should it be first person or should it be third person? And immediately, you seize up. My suggestion is write the first draft first person, because that's your comfort zone. And because that's the way you talk, that's the way you tell stories. And then look at it after it's done, and you can make changes in the second draft. But write it, and write it straight through, because the first draft sucks. It's a steaming pile of clay that you're then going to mold and make better. Just keep that forward momentum going, because when you get to the end, it's done. It sucks, but it's done. And then you can go back and make it better.
Oh, so well said. I bump into two types of people: those that have thought about writing for a book forever, and just as many, those who have started writing a book 5 years ago and they're on their 19th edit of chapter one. And so I love what you said, and I'm an advocate of that too. Just put the, like a horse getting ready for the Preakness.
Yeah.
Blinders on, keep pushing straight forward. Let's get ourselves a 50,000 word manuscript, 70,000 word manuscript, and then go back. Only part I disagree is I don't think it'll be steaming quite like you say. I think if we just let it go, it goes.
Yeah. But have
But
fun with it. It has to be fun. The process needs to be fun. And if it's not fun, ask yourself, well, what's the problem? And if you can fix it, if it's not fun, you can find a way around it. But forward momentum and having fun and just doing it.
there you go. That's right. It's got to be a labor of love. Well, I'll leave with one thing. You said earlier that you have procrastination. I think the people we're talking about right now also suffer from procrastination. But I want to remind people that if you really study procrastination, and I've studied it, I'm a subject matter expert on it. I've lived it. I've watched it. I've read about it. And one of the things that was really helpful to me to learn about procrastination is people confuse it with laziness. It's not laziness. We're not talking about laziness. We're talking about just reprioritizing a day that excludes what we really wanted to get to that day. But at the end of the day, it's a fully functioning, effective day. We just didn't take care of the part that we wanted to take care of. So, yeah, go ahead.
I will amend that. I mean, I agree with you on that. It's not laziness, but if you're ruminating about your story, that's writing. And you don't have to be sitting in front of a computer or moving your fingers or whatever to be a writer. If you're thinking about it, that's part of the process and a valuable part. But of course, eventually you gotta, get off of the couch and do it.
There you go. All right. One last time. How do people get a hold of you?
JohnDedakis.com, JohnDedakis.com.
There you go. And don't forget, we're going to check out that book on Amazon. We want to make sure we're looking for enemies domestic. And don't just check it out. Go grab yourself a copy and read that copy so that you can put a nice review up there. And that
Oh,
goes for
thank
you
you.
ebook people as well. I'll give you a little trick about Amazon, and I actually appreciate they do this. You can buy a book on Amazon, still is an unverified review until the program sees that you've read at least 30% of the book. Now, I don't know about reading, but that you've moved through 30% of the book. So let's grab a copy. One of the nicest things you can ever do for another individual is not only buy their book, but write a quick, easy review. It really means a lot to the author, and I hope everybody will do that.
Thanks, Rob. That sounds great.
You bet. And thank you for being on the show. Great talking to you. Really enjoyed the conversation. We've both been taking some good notes. I think it worked out well for both of us today.
It did. Thanks.
You bet. Well, we'll do it again as well as we can next time, everybody. Until then, stay safe.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's guest author, we'd love you to rate, review, and share this episode with others. If you'd like more information on today's guest or the Maryland Writers Association, please visit our website at marylandwriters.org. You can also hear a brief history of the Maryland Writers Association by listening to Episode 0.